is the NT Country Hour on ABC Radio Darwin and the Northern Territory.
G'day there, my name's Matt Brand. Welcome to the program and happy International Rural Women's Day. A biosecurity alert has been issued for the mango industry after an exotic pest was found in some orchards over in Queensland. I'll be telling you more about the mango shoot looper in just a moment. We've also got news today about some Chinese ports banning the export of fertilisers. And mining giant Rio Tinto says it's seen plenty of benefits from using virtual fencing on one of its cattle stations.
If something like virtual fencing is successful in the long term, and you don't have to install fences, you don't have to maintain fences, everything that goes with it. So after every flood, you lose 50% of your fences. With virtual fencing, it's just there to stay. You know exactly where it is at any point in time.
That and plenty more coming up before 1:30. Let's get into it. We're broadcasting right across the territory on the ABC. We're on the television via Channel 25, and g'day if you are tuning in via our podcast. Now, one of Australia's most well-known live export companies has emerged from voluntary administration and with a brand new owner. North Australian Cattle Company, NACC. It was founded in 1980 and was run by elders for nearly three decades until its sale to a Chinese-Australian buyer in 2017. Now, you might remember earlier this year, the company went into administration with debts reportedly of $3.6 million. Well, today on the Country Hour, we can tell you that NACC is back. Ashley James is the new owner and general manager of NACC. I spoke to him just a short time ago.
Yes, well, over the last few months, I've been lucky enough to work with a few investors, and we've managed to purchase North Australian Cattle Company from the administrators, which was finalised yesterday.
Are you willing to say for how much?
I'd prefer not to. Sorry, Matt.
No, understood. So tell us about the new owners. Who's in charge of NACC?
Okay, so North Australian Cattle Company was purchased by myself. I was able to get another couple of investors who are in agriculture and they're willing to join me for the ride and the challenge coming up.
The live export trade, we keep hearing, is facing a lot of challenges at the moment. So for you, why take this on?
Oh, there's a few reasons, Matt. I think one is it's a iconic live export company, NACC. And as you said, it was started in the 80s, and I believe that, you know, hopefully we can keep it running for another 50 years. It's not the greatest time to start it, but I guess when, you know, there is never a good time, especially in this industry, but we're willing to have a go. And as a startup, I guess we're going back to being a startup company. We don't have the pressures of shipping. I don't have any long-term charters at the moment. We're going to start small and hopefully get through a wet season, and then when we can look at long-term charters of vessels.
When would you be hoping to do the first shipment?
I'd like to be doing one tomorrow if possible, but look, I'm talking to customers and I'm hoping in November I've got a ship on the water and off to Southeast Asia.
In terms of staff, where are you at?
Staff, it'll be myself at the moment. Obviously, there's a bit going on with the administrators still. Unfortunately, all the staff, previous staff of NACC, including myself, was left high and dry. I'd love to be able to offer some of the staff new employment, which I hope I can do in the future. But at the moment, I'll be doing everything myself.
Are you able to provide us some background as to what went wrong with the previous owners?
I think it was more of the shareholders didn't agree on on how the business should be run. There was one in Australia and two in China, and they didn't agree. Obviously, it's a business that needs cash to run, and cash flow wasn't forthcoming from the shareholders.
For you, what do you think the key is to running a successful live export business?
I think at the moment, Matt, it's running pretty lean. But the key is having good customers and good relationships with customers. And we'll look at opening up a few more new markets. But then also at the same time, really concentrating on our key markets, which will be Indonesia and Vietnam.
What could new markets be?
New markets for myself, Matt. You know, we may look into having a look at more of the breeder markets. At some stage, I'd like to head back to China once politically that's sorted out. But yeah, we just as a new company, I guess we need to have a look at any markets that are available. And, you know, we'll also look at a few air freights as well.
So as you say, a new company, are you going to keep the old name of NACC?
Oh, Matt, that's a given. That was one of the key reasons we got into this. I mean, it would have been easy, and it would have been a hell of a lot faster if we had have just, if I had gone to the department and started up, you know, and company ABC is a live export company, but I thought it important to keep North Australian Cattle Company and the business running. And thankfully now it's back in Australian hands and we can watch it grow for another 50 years.
That's Ashley James, the new owner and general manager of North Australian Cattle Company, NACC, is back. You can read more about this story up online right now if you go searching for NT Country Hour.
Hello, my name is Beatrice and I'm from Wadea.
Hello, my name is Stephanie Berda and I'm from Wadea.
Hello, my name is Eugenie Gilbert. I'm from Wadea.
And you're listening to Country Hour.
Today is the UN's International Day of Rural Women. And the theme this year is Rural Women Cultivating Good Food for All. Territory champion Tiani Cook is the president of the Australian Women in Agriculture Group. She told Dan Fitzgerald how she's celebrating Rural Women's Day.
Thanks, Dan. Yeah, we're having a fantastic luncheon here at the Bundaberg Botanic Gardens at the Ferry Meadow House. There's about 80-odd women here from right across the agricultural sector. And we've got Pip Courtney's actually the guest speaker. So really looking forward to a fantastic day. We're all just actually taking our chairs and they're just bringing our entrees. So it's shaping up to be a lovely afternoon.
On Rural Women's Day, what sort of conversations are you having with women there at the lunch?
Yeah, well, we're definitely food is definitely one of the big topics focusing on cultivating foods and we're really looking forward to sitting down and enjoying a meal and having a couple of drinks and I guess, you know, when everybody's been so busy with cattle work and farming and everything, we've just done a few days of cattle work out in the Western Wide Bay Burnett here on my brother's properties. So been having a lovely few days. But, celebrating women right across Australia and right across the world on this Rural Women's Day. I spoke to a lovely organisation with, you know, a bit of collaboration called Good Return, and they focus on Asia Pacific women. So also, you know, thinking about all the women overseas as well, you know, across agriculture and, you know, where our food and fibre come from. So, yeah, it's a fantastic day to celebrate rural women.
Yeah, rural women make a big part of the agricultural workforce, especially in developing countries where there's something like 40% of the labour force. The UN's theme this year is Rural Women Cultivating Good Food for All. Do you think women's role in food production is recognised enough?
Look, we always, I guess, you know, we work alongside our men, and we always, we need to be conscious that there's, you know, there's always opportunity for more, I guess, capacity for women in agriculture. And, you know, we're I think we're on the right track. There's just, you know, there's some fantastic movements allowing us as women to be more productive. And it's, you know, it's something that I think, you know, both men and women can be proud of, where, you know, we're advocating that, and it feels like we're going in the right direction, Dan, yeah.
Over your time involved in agriculture, have you seen the role of women change?
Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely. I think as technology really starts to come into the industry, it allows, you know, there's not so much of an emphasis on the need for brawn, I guess, within the industry. Like, you know, we've got hydraulic head crushers, cattle crushers. There's just so many different things that we're able to do as, I guess, you know, in inverted commas, the weaker sex. So definitely lots of changes moving forward. And I think it's, you know, it's all coming back to technology and the ability to allow some of those sorts of things to take over the heavy lifting for us.
Just lastly, Tiani, is there a rural woman you'd like to give a shout out to today?
Absolutely, Dan. I would love to give a shout out to my mum. So Letty Cook, I think she is the epitome of integrity and humility. She's just one of the most amazing people. I'm very proud of my mum. And I'm here today with my, as one of seven sisters, so my actual sisters and my sisters-in-laws. So, you know, I think I speak on behalf of all of us girls when we say, you know, we aspire to be like mum. And yeah, she's just a all-round good chick.
Good stuff. Well, I hope you have a good day. Thanks for having a chat with the Country Hour.
That's great. Thanks, Dan. Thanks for your time.
Tiani Cook, who is the president of Australian Women in Agriculture, and a happy International Day of Rural Women to you. It is 18 to 1 here on the Country Hour. We asked Tiani if there was a song or an artist that she would love to hear on today's Country Hour. She requested a bit of Shania, and that gets the big thumbs up from me. Hope you enjoy it.
Mind if I sit down? I'm out of here.
There you go, Tiani Cook. Hope you enjoyed that. Hope you all enjoyed a bit of Shania Twain on a Friday afternoon. It is 13 to 1 here on the Country Hour. Now, over the last few months, we've been hearing a lot about the rising cost of fertiliser. It's on the up and up, and it doesn't look to be getting any better. News has come out of China this week that the government over there has banned some ports from exporting fertiliser. Andrew Whitlaw is from Thomas Elder Markets. He explains the current situation.
The reason they're doing that is, well, if they reduce exports to the likes of Australia, then what happens is then that means that fertilizer will become cheaper within Australia, within China, sorry, which will encourage their farmers to buy more fertilizer and then have stronger yields.
So and last night, some Chinese ports banned the export of fertiliser from those ports.
That's right, yeah. So it's another big issue for us because, you know, we get more than 60% of our DAP and MAP and about 15% of our urea from China. So we will be looking to alternate origins for large chunks of that.
So if prices are high, that's one thing. It's going to be more expensive for farmers to buy fertiliser and use it. But if there are bans in places from some of our largest sort of suppliers of fertiliser, that's another thing. Are there concerns Australian farmers won't be able to get the fertiliser they need for next crop?
Look, I don't want to scare anyone at this point of the period, because I've got a long time to go before we need a fertiliser. What we find is typically that trade flows change. You know, we've seen it with our barley. We can't send it to China, so we send it to Saudi Arabia. There are alternate origins for our fertilizer. Like, we get most of our urea from the Middle East anyway. We will find alternate options. We'll find alternate origins for the fertilizer. What it's doing is it is meaning that the prices are going to be higher because you've lost a big chunk of supply. And similar actions happening in Russia. Russia is focusing their fertilizer on the domestic farmers to encourage them to grow more.
So is there a date or a month or something that we really should be keeping an eye on in terms of knowing what kind of supply there will be and the ability to get it to Australia in time for the next crop?
Well, the scary thing is that all the reports out of China is that all of this action against fertilizer exports is due to continue right through until June, which, you know, is basically the point of time when Chinese farmers will have purchased all of their requirements. And obviously we, our import program is due to start ramping up, and we'll obviously be looking to purchase our fertilizer as farmers prior to seeding in a lot of cases. And so, look, I think it is just a case of we will get what we want. We have had issues in the past when there's been concerns. Like last year, we were concerned that we wouldn't get fertilizer because of COVID. We got all we needed, and we managed to actually import quite a substantial volume last year. The market tends to still operate. It's just a case of, you know, our expectations and those of, you know, if you ask any analyst around the world, would be that, you know, fertilizer prices are liable to stay strong.
That's Andrew Whitlaw from Thomas Elder Markets talking fertiliser prices there with Warwick Long. Now, as you heard on the Country Hour yesterday, commercial fishers have noticed an increase in the number of illegal fishing boats coming into our northern waters. And that's backed up by the Australian Fisheries Management Authority, which says more than 100 boats have been intercepted in the past 3 months. AFMA's Peter Venslovis says illegal vessels have been intercepted closer and closer to the Australian mainland.
They have been picked up close to the inside of or the outer edge of the Australian fishing zone, several miles in. But now they're becoming more of an issue in terms of moving down into waters deeper into the Australian fishing zone.
And how does that figure of, what was it, sorry, 101, was it? How does that compare with sort of, I guess, a rough average for that period of time?
That compares to 85 vessels that were apprehended last financial year. That's 30, or 1 July 2020 to 30 June 2021. But prior to that, numbers were in their 10s or 20s per year. But we aren't experiencing the numbers that we experienced in the mid-2000s when there were hundreds of vessels being intercepted each year. For example, in the 2005-2006 financial year, there was over 600 vessels intercepted in Australian waters. But following various measures that were put in place, those numbers dropped in the late 2000s down to 10 to 20 per year on average.
But there has been a bit of an uptick, though, by the sounds of it, in the last sort of 2 years. What do you think might be driving that?
Well, it's a number of factors. Australian fish stocks are extremely well managed, so they act as a draw card themselves and as a target for illegal foreign fishers. But there's other push factors that could be behind it as well. COVID issues in places like Indonesia, folks moving back to their regional towns, townships and so forth, away from areas where they used to have jobs, such as Bali and so forth, and the tourism industry is an issue potentially. And also damage potentially by Cyclone Seroja and the need for operators to make money to recover their losses.
Has COVID-19 changed at all the response, the enforcement action that's been taken by the Australian authorities in dealing with this?
The activities on the water in terms of surveillance in the right areas is certainly there, and we are, well, Maritime Border Command, who is the agency responsible for surveillance of Australian waters in the north and various other parts around Australia, have surveillance flights over key areas regularly, And they also vector patrol boats to intercept and take action against vessels should they be detected in Australian waters. And that certainly has happened. With this increase in activity, there's been a greater level of tempo of Australian patrol vessels targeting the areas in which the vessels are coming into, hence the number of enforcement actions that have been taken at sea has increased.
In the past, there have been, I think, quite a few boats destroyed and actually people, whether they're charged or taken to detention if they're found illegally fishing. Is that still occurring? And if not, why not?
COVID certainly has had an impact, and there has been a change in the way that enforcement action has been taken. In terms of what happens now, vessels, when intercepted, have their catch and their fishing equipment seized at sea, and in some instances where circumstances are right, vessels are also seized and disposed of at sea. So the enforcement responses had to be amended to take account of current circumstances and ensure that COVID-safe methods of interaction are implemented, and to ensure the safety of the crews on board the patrol vessels that intercept the illegal fishing vessels, and also to ensure the safety of the Australian public, to bring fishers into Australia in the current environment is just very risky.
So the action taken then in regards to those people that were fishing, they are instructed to leave Australian waters and actually sort of escorted, accompanied by another vessel? Is that sort of what's happening mostly?
Following the enforcement action, vessels are then either ordered to leave the AFZ or escorted out of Australian waters.
That is Peter Van Slovis, who is with the Australian Fisheries Management Authority. He was speaking there to Aaron Park. Right across the territory, on the ABC, you are tuned into the Country Hour. There was some concerning news for mango growers overnight. I'll tell you more about it next.
Know a young person who's up to something great? The ABC is looking for trailblazers aged 18 to 28 who are doing inspiring things in their regional town.
Projects that strengthen the pride in my community.
To give young women, particularly rural women, their voice.
Trailblazers will have their work featured on the ABC and receive an amazing package of support. Apply now for the Trailblazer program at abc.net.au/trailblazers. Hurry, entries close November 10.
G'day, how are you going? It's Leo Skliros here, President of the Northern Territory Mango Industry Association, and you're listening to The Country Hour.
Okay, the mango industry is on the alert after an exotic pest was found on some farms in North Queensland. Dan Fitzgerald joins me in the studio. What can you tell us?
It is called the mango shoot looper, Matt. It had never been seen in Australia before, but the Queensland Department of Agriculture, it has confirmed that this pest has been found on three properties in the Mareeba region, and it is undertaking a bit more surveillance now to see just how far it might have spread. So it's a type of moth. It's originally from Southeast Asia. The mango shoot looper larvae, they feed on mango leaves, and they pretty much trim them right down just to their stems. They also feed on tender shoots, some flowers, immature fruit. A note here we have from Queensland Ag is that severe infestations can cause 80 to 100% of leaf and flower damage on affected trees and cause significant crop losses. So, yeah, the pest, it commonly goes for mangoes and lychees, but it can also target rambutan and long, and they're all potential hosts.
My goodness me. Now, we have asked one of the head entomologists in the Northern Territory to join us today, but he's a bit busy. I'm sure we'll learn more about this on Monday's Country Hour. Now, just while you're here, Dan, I want you to have a listen to this countdown and epic reaction out of Italy this month.
Five, four, three, two, one. Silencio.
That, dear Dan, is the sound of Stefano Cutrupi from Italy claiming the world record for the biggest ever pumpkin. You and I have seen a picture of this. 1,226 kilos of pumpkin.
It is something to behold. And the farmer's reaction, it's like he's won a boxing match. He's punching the air.
He's
so, so pumped. He must have put a lot of work into that pumpkin. And it's all being released.
Yeah, and it's a big deal for Italy. They've taken the title off Belgium, so there's a bit of European rivalry going on. It's awesome. You can find the video on YouTube or you can watch it on Landline this Sunday. Well done to Stefano. Hey, it is news time here on the ABC. I'll catch you back here in five for more Country Hour.
G'day, my name's Will Weir from WTW Brahmins. I live out at Amaru Station and I've just started my own Brahmin stud. You're listening to the NT Country Hour.
Matt Brown with you this afternoon. It has been talked about for years, but Rio Tinto is doing it and feels there's a big future in virtual fencing.
If something like virtual fencing is successful in the long term, and you don't have to install fences, you don't have to maintain fences, everything that goes with it. So after every flood, you lose 50% of your fences. With virtual fencing, It's just there to stay. You know exactly where it is at any point in time.
Yeah, we're off to Hemlersley Station very soon on the Country Hour to check that out. Let's go to the Weather Bureau. Ange Broussard is there this afternoon. And the radars look a little bit quiet this afternoon, Ange.
Yes, it certainly is, Matt. Good afternoon. We have started seeing a few early thunderstorms generally near the coast of the Carpentaria district. There should be more on the way, but a bit more isolated compared to yesterday.
Compared to yesterday.
The storms are expected over the Northern Daly, much of the Arnhem and to the eastern parts of Carpentaria today.
Can you share with us some of the rainfall figures up to 9 a.m? There's a few there.
Yes, a few there. So not as much as we were expecting. Howard River, which is near Howard Springs, got 18.5 millimetres. The storm inland of Darwin yesterday was spectacular, Matt. Just didn't make it all the way to the coast, unfortunately.
Yes.
So that storm produced that rainfall. Fenny Creek on the Daly River had 17.2. Adelaide River Station, 14. MacArthur River, there were some good storms there yesterday afternoon, got 13.8. Nooka got a bit of a rainfall there, 9 millimetres there. Around Darwin itself, I think the highest we saw was at Pinelands, got 1.4 there at 11 mile. Those are some of the figures. Mm. And Bulman also got 2.8 millimetres.
The weekend ahead for Territorians, what's the story?
So the showers and thunderstorms, the focus will shift to western top end from tomorrow. So we are seeing some drier extend into the Carpentaria and to the Arnhem from tomorrow. And what that means is the heat wave will return to the eastern parts of the top end from Sunday, whereas the showers and thunderstorms will be concentrated over the western parts of the top end from tomorrow. The showers and thunderstorms will extend into the Gregory tomorrow and then maybe further south into the southern parts of the territory on Sunday. And this is due to a trough that will approach from WA. So that will help extend moisture and instability into central Australia on Sunday. This trough, once it moves through, there's another much larger trough approaching the Northern Territory next week. It's not likely to move across the territory or the southern parts of the territory until Wednesday. So until then, this combination of two troughs are going to maintain quite warm north to northwesterly winds across much of the territory. And so the heat that's building up across the eastern parts of the top end, and also across the top, across the Kimberley, will expand into Central Australia as early as Monday. So we're going to see vast areas of 40 plus degree days across a very large area of the territory. The only place that we'll see less temperatures less than 40 will be the western parts of the Daly. So yes, a very hot air mass is going to descend on the territory next week, and will stick around until at least Wednesday or Thursday. Showers and thunderstorms will remain generally isolated next week, mainly over the western Daly if they do happen. Elsewhere, it's generally going to be dry and very hot, Matt.
Can we learn more about this heat wave next week? Because it seems widespread and quite yes. severe. It's, I'd imagine it's been a while since the Territory has seen something like this.
Yes. So it looks like that the heat wave will be low to severe initially across the eastern top end, and then it'll descend into the central parts of the territory from Monday onwards and hang around until later in the week. The heat wave over the Arnhem District will develop into an extreme heat wave situation from Tuesday onwards. Now, in terms of effects, it's depending on, you know, whether it's low or severe or extreme. These are the three levels, and what it has got various implications. So for low intensity heat waves, most people can cope during these heat waves. With severe heat waves, it's really the vulnerable people, such as the elderly and the very young, particularly those with medical conditions, that may find it quite challenging. And under extreme heat waves, these are quite rare, but it is likely to happen in the eastern top end next week.
Yep.
It's for pretty much everyone. People who work or exercise outdoors are at a greater risk, and it's for people who don't take precautions to keep cool.
And it's the length of it as well. I mean, I'm looking at the forecast for Nooka. Hello to everyone in Nooka this afternoon. Monday, a top of 42, then 43 on Tuesday, 43 Wednesday, 42 Thursday. When's the relief come in?
It's not likely to happen for much of the territory until the end of next week, Matt. So we do see showers and thunderstorms increasing across the northern parts of the territory from Friday. For the southern parts of the territory, for Lassiter and Simpson, there is a cooler change heading your way on Thursday. So temperatures will drop by about 5 degrees, and that will help to reduce the very hot conditions or ease the very hot conditions. These slightly cooler temperatures will move into the southern Barkly on Friday, so you will see temperatures drop a few degrees there as well. Generally, we do start to see showers and thunderstorms returning across the northern parts of the territory, including the top end and the central districts, the Carpentaria, the Barkly, especially the northern parts of the Barkly and the Gregory from Friday onwards.
Yeah, okay. Thanks for your time this afternoon, Ange. And hey, big news in the pumpkin world. A fella over in Italy has grown one that weighs 1,226 kilos. Brand new world record.
Gosh, that's more than a ton, isn't it?
Yeah, more than a ton. 1.2 tons.
Gosh.
Of pumpkin.
Wow. Would that be edible?
I don't think you'd bother. I don't think you'd bother with it. Makes for one hell of a jack-o'-lantern, though, doesn't it? That would scare the kids, yeah.
You could create a house out of that.
You could live in it, yep.
Yep.
Have a lovely Friday, Ange. Good to hear from you.
You too. Bye-bye.
Ange Prasad there at the Weather Bureau. Producer Dan, did you win a ribbon one year at the Catherine Show? Came third or something? How big was that one? 60 kilos? Yeah, right, 60 kilos. We've got work to do.
G'day, this is Vin Yuen from TV Farms in Sydney Markets, and you're listening to The Country Hour.
You are, you are. Now, cattle prices, as you know, they've been at record highs this year, but not everything is going to plan for NT stations, with some properties really struggling to find enough workers. Out at Lakefield Station near Mataranka, it's been a slow start to their third round of mustering, and that is not by choice. Owner Gary Riggs had a chat to Max Rowley.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, we've taken advantage of the market prices. It gives us the opportunity to clean out a few older cattle that we didn't need. But because we've gone through eight, nine years of bad seasons, we carried our full production numbers right through that period of time. And we also realised that we did have a good wet season, but we needed to drop our carrying capacity a little bit. So we made the decision to drop over 1,000 head of cattle extra off the property, and that coincided with high cattle prices. So it was a win-win situation for us. There's prices that I've never seen in my whole life in North Australia, and selling cows for prices that sort of you just dream about, and the same with your steers and heifers and bulls. Selling bulls, and you only got to sell it. Put a little bit extra money to them and you got a brand new bull for the amount of money that we're getting for a whole bull. So cattle prices and steers are just, we got $4.20 for our first bunch of steers at the start of the year, and then sort of over $4 for everything else. And then even just a couple of days ago, I got $4.30.
You said you're up to your third round now. What do you usually do in the third round?
Third round for Lakeville is we do all our breeders. We've got 2,200 breeders, and we go through and we vaccinate them, preg test, and then we bank tail them and segregate them into different paddocks, into their wet season carbon paddocks. That's our breeders, and then we poke through all our steers that haven't been sold, and we do the same. We vaccinate and process them fellas, give them backline and all their vaccines, and then we'll move on to our last year young cattle, and we'll go through all those, the same thing again, segregate them. The heifers will come out and go into the breeding, the bigger ones, and then the smaller ones will go into a separate paddocks. All the big steers will come off and be lined up ready for sale in February next year. The smaller fellas will be segregated and they'll come up for sale in around August. We do all our maiden heifers as well, so we go through the whole herd this time of the year.
How long does the third round usually take you?
Third round for us takes us about 4 weeks, 4 to 5 weeks on the outside. But this year is a bit different. We're short of staff. It's very difficult getting staff, and we're only getting 3 days a week on cattle movements, so we're getting one paddock a week out of 15 paddocks full of cattle, and we're doing one a week basically, and that's just because of not having enough staff.
So it usually takes about a month. Yeah. How long is it going to take you this year?
Well, we've already done 5 weeks and we've got another 5 weeks to go, so yeah, we're doing 10 weeks because we're only getting 3 days a week on cattle, because all the rest of the time is either running boars, feeding out supplement, and just basically keeping a check on, because this time of the year it's very dry, hot, windy, and if a water goes down somewhere, you've got to get it. That takes priority on everything, and it's got to be maintained to get back up and running. So, we haven't been able to just jump in and do the cattle all through the week, whereas if I had been able to employ a sort of handy person that could do boars, supplement and stuff like that, I've been trying all year, and we've had probably at least five inquire. Three of them were in COVID situations, so they weren't able to come anyway, and two of them at the last minute pulled out on me before they even got here.
Where do you usually get your workers from?
Well, days gone by, it was country life. But now it's sort of more social media. There's a lot of social media sites that have job areas in them. You just drop an ad in there, and normally you get some out of it fairly quick. You'll get a heap of inquiries. But I've done it at least three or four times this year, and I've had next to no inquiries on it. You get one or two. And then they're normally very young people, just testing the waters, I think. So basically, they're the places we normally would have been trying this year, but up until COVID, we'd have a couple of backpackers on our first round, again on our second round and our third round. But also on our second round, we'd have the NIAP kids from Indonesia. But that's been out the window for the last few years too, because of COVID. And so, yeah, those guys are very helpful. And they feel really good, you know, do a lot of skills that we needed. And you have to train them. But once they learn, they're good people, you know. And the same with backpackers. They're very intelligent, most of the backpacker people that's around. And they may not have a skill set that we needed, but the main thing is they're very enthusiastic and very smart. So they're easy to train and easy to work with. So backpackers have always been good. COVID stopped that.
So what's your thoughts looking ahead then?
Get rid of COVID, get everyone vaccinated, and try and manage it, and have try and let people flow freely around the country for the pastoral industry. You know, we're not the only ones struggling. The grain industry, the small crops, the cattle, the sheep, everyone's struggling to get staff, and that's because of the people not being able to move around so much.
Gary Riggs from Lakefield Station speaking there to Max Rowley. It is 20 past one here on the Country Hour. After weeks and so much talk of will he or won't he, well, the Prime Minister Scott Morrison has just confirmed that he will attend next month's Glasgow Climate Summit. Now, Mr. Morrison is yet to strike a deal with the National Party over whether Australia will commit to achieving net zero emissions by 2050. But he is off to Glasgow. He spoke to the media just a short time ago. Let's have a listen.
The government will be finalising its position for me to take to that summit prior to my departure over the next fortnight. We are working through those issues with our cabinet and with our colleagues, and I look forward to those discussions concluding over the next couple of weeks. And I simply say to everyone that net zero was an outcome that I outlined at the beginning of this year, consistent with our Paris commitments. The challenge is not about the if and the when, the challenge is about the how. And I'm very focused on the how, because the global changes that are happening in our economy as a result of the response to climate change have a real impact, and they will have a real impact here in Australia. And the plan that I'm taking forward, together with my colleagues, is about ensuring that our regions are strong, that our region's jobs are not only protected, but they have opportunities for the future. It's not just about hitting net zero. That's an important environmental goal. But what's important is Australia's economy goes from strength to strength, and the livelihoods and the lives that Australians know, particularly in rural and regional areas, are able to go forward with hope and with confidence. And that's what my plan will be all about, and I look forward to furthering those discussions in the weeks ahead.
The Prime Minister, Scott Morrison, he is off to the Glasgow Climate Summit next month. That's news just in. We are talking virtual fencing on the Country Hour next. Don't carry me too far away. We're on across the territory on a Friday afternoon. You are tuned into the Country Hour. For years it's been talked about, and Rio Tinto is actually doing it, trialling virtual fencing on one of its cattle stations there in WA. So, as it sounds, instead of having fence posts and wires, Rio is using cattle collar technology to make virtual fences. This trial's been done on Hemsley Station near Tom Price out in the Pilbara. Sim Mathwin is Rio Tinto's pastoral manager and hopes what's been trialled there could get rolled out for the entire industry.
Rio Tinto owns 6 pastoral stations, and it's a way of contributing back to the pastoral industry, which we know our mines exist on. The second reason, which is much more practical from the benefits for Rio, is like long term the aim is to prevent cattle accessing Rio Tinto infrastructure, railway lines, etc. On Hammersley it's 250,000 hectares. I run a breeding herd of about 2,500 head, but there is quite a lot of rail that cuts up Hammersley Station. I mean, it's an interesting conundrum because it is run as a pastoral lease, but it's within a mining company, and so there can be some challenges, but I think one of the benefits we've got to go is around something like the virtual fencing. We can create that opportunity with the intent of you know, maybe being a catalyst for regional economic development in the pastoral industry in a new way that maybe you can run cattle. You know, it's got a long way to go, something like virtual fencing, but the opportunities are obviously there.
And how is it going at the moment?
Oh, it's really good. Yeah, so the trial is run over three phases. The first phase we've already done with 20 head of cattle, and that went well. Yeah, there were no significant issues with that. The current trial's with 100, and we've just turned the virtual fence on for those 100 about 26th of August. That trial will run for another 2 months, and then we're going to run with 500 head next year. But overall, it's gone really well. Yeah.
And so would you aim in the end to have a collar for every head of cattle on these pastoral leases?
I don't think so. We've got about a 2,500 head breeding herd. You know, the collars, there's work involved with them and at cost. We'd probably think about putting collars on the animals that were going to deliver the most value. So, you know, you might have your 2,500 breeding herd, but say 500 heifers are the ones you really want to look after and manage well. Then, yeah, we'd put them on those 500. But in the long term, you know, the opportunities around being able to muster using virtual fencing, being able to move animals to where you want them to graze, you know, long term, yeah, we might put them on all 2,500 head. Yep,
and
for sure.
And what is the cost?
The way we do it is it's about $40 per head per year, per collar. So it's a lease arrangement. What I like about that is, so there's two ways you can do it. You can either buy the collar. But of course, in this area, the technology is going to change quickly. So if you own that collar, then 3 years' time, it's redundant. This way, you lease the collar, and as new models come in, you will get that new model. Yeah, so about $40 per collar.
Obviously, people would be looking at this and thinking Rio Tinto have deep pockets, it's easy for them to do it. Do you think this could be applied to any pastoral operation?
Yes. I mean, look, honestly, I wouldn't be involved with doing it if I didn't see the potential. It's like with any pastoral operation, you'd need to make the decision to change the way you're going to run your entire operation, because that's what it gives you the ability to do. But Rio's got that opportunity to do this type of investment, and really we want to share the knowledge we gain from this for the broader pastoral industry. I mean, if you go really blue sky, they talk about being able to almost single site mate, because you know which animals mated with which dam and that sort of thing. But if you just look simply at the infrastructure, so if something like virtual fencing is successful in the long term, and you don't have to install fences, you don't have to maintain fences, you don't have to grade your fences, everything that goes with it. So after every flood, you lose 50% of your fences, your cattle move from the paddock you put them in because now that fence is gone. With virtual fencing, it's just there to stay. You know exactly where it is at any point in time.
That is Sim Mathwin from Rio Tinto speaking to James Liveris about the company's virtual fencing trial. And you can see more on this story this Sunday, Landline at 12:30. Tune in to that to learn more about Rio and its virtual fences. And make sure you stick around for the market report so that you can check out the video of that world record pumpkin. Enjoy the rest of your Friday afternoon and keep it rural.